My name is Mike McQuarrie. I'm an associate professor in the sociology department here at LSE, and I'm here to welcome all of you and Matt on behalf of the Inequalities Institute. We are here to talk about Matt's book, Evicted. Matthew is the John Loeb Associate Professor of the Social Sciences at Harvard University. He is the author of four books, another ethnography, On the Fireline, Living and Dying with Wildland Firefighters, Race in America, co-authored with Mustafa Emmerbayer, The Racial Order, also co-authored with Mustafa Emmerbayer, and Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, which is the subject of tonight's talk. Just a little bit about this book. It's been received very well. In a review for the New York Times, Barbara Ehrenreich plausibly argues that Desmond is setting a new standard for reporting on poverty, as well as doing social science on poverty. William Julius Wilson, who is probably the unofficial dean of sociologists of American poverty, called Desmond's book a call to action on par with Michael Harrington's The Other America. We can only hope that, like that book, the outcome will be a renewed war on poverty in the United States. And finally, last year, Desmond was the recipient of a prestigious MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. So please join me tonight in welcoming Matthew Desmond, author of Evicted.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for taking time out of your super busy days to come here to talk. It's really great to see my good friend Mike after you took him away and brought him here. And Mike and I have been friends for a long time, and I've learned a lot from you over the years, so it's really great to be here with you and with all the folks, especially the folks that are studying cities and inequality here that I've learned from over the years. It's really good to see you again. America's weird, it's unmatched by any standards of rich democracy for the depth and expanse of this poverty. We have way more poverty in America and way worse poverty in America compared to any other industrialized democracy. And that fact has always troubled me. It's always bothered me. I always felt that was wholly unnecessary. And I wanted to kind of get my head around that problem and see it from the ground level. And I wanted to see how housing plays a role in deepening poverty in the American city. And so I decided to study eviction, the act of throwing families out of their home. And so I did a few things. I started by moving into a trailer park on the far south side of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is a city in the Midwest. It used to be neck and neck with Chicago as like the Midwest metropolis. Chicago won, but Milwaukee still there, still a major American city. It's the 30th most populous city in the country. And so I moved into a trailer park and I rented a trailer in a mobile home park that was nicknamed the Shame of the South Side by the news media because it had so many housing problems and code violations. And I lived in that trailer for about 5 months, and then I moved into a rooming house on the north side of the city, which is the traditional inner city neighborhood in Milwaukee, and I lived there for about 10 months. And from those two neighborhoods, I followed families getting evicted. So I went to eviction court with them. I followed them to shelters and vetted homes. I watched their kids. I slept on their couches. I ate from their tables. I went to AA meetings with them, and counseling sessions with them, and church with them, and funerals with them, and even a birth. And try to just deeply ingrain myself into their everyday life, to really understand what their life is like on a day-to-day basis. But at the same time, I knew that to really understand this thing, I needed to understand landlords' perspectives as well. So if you were getting evicted, I wanted to get just as deep with your landlord doing the evicting as I did with you. So I did that, and I went to eviction court with landlords, and I watched them pass out eviction notices. I understood what ticked them off or made them happy. I saw them buy and sell properties. I have a good idea of why someone would buy and operate property in some of the most dangerous and poorest neighborhoods in a city like Milwaukee. And as I spent more time in tenants and landlords, I found myself needing answers to very basic questions like, how often does eviction happen? Who does it happen to? What are the consequences of eviction? So I went looking for studies and data that would allow me to answer that, those set of questions. You know, and I found like nothing, which is surprising. You know, this is a study about poverty, about cities, but here's the private housing market. It was consuming most of the incomes of the families that I was spending time with. It was dictating where they lived, who they lived with. It was destabilizing families and entire communities. and we basically didn't know anything about it. And so I tried to ignore these questions because I just wanted to hang out with people all day. But the more they kept me up, the more we decided to do a few things. One thing we did is did a survey called the Milwaukee Area Research Study, or MARS for short, because every good survey has to be branded and have an acronym. So ours is MARS. And we ended up talking to about 1,000 renters in the city of Milwaukee, all over the city. We went to a very good neighborhood in the city. We went to very bad neighborhoods in the city. One interviewer, we interviewed people in their homes. One interviewer was mugged. Another one was bit by a dog. I was actually the same interviewer. I need to work on situational awareness. But we worked really hard with this data. We got an 84% response rate, which means it's really high quality data, especially for a survey, largely in low-income areas. We didn't stop there. I analyzed over hundreds of thousands of eviction records, millions of 911 calls, hundreds of nuisance property ordinances. We surveyed 250 people in eviction court, and I put all that kind of big data in conversation with my field work, what I was seeing on the ground on an everyday level. And I think each of those methods kind of worked off one another. They kind of informed each other, and each kept the others on it. So evicted follows 8 families. Some are black, some are white, some have kids, some don't. Wrapped up in the process of eviction. So we meet Lorraine, who is my neighbor at the trailer park, who is a grandmother, who had to decide between paying her rent or paying the gas bill if she wanted to take a hot shower. We meet Lamar, who's this like single dad of 2 teenage boys, who's trying to make it in the inner city, and he's wheelchair bound. He falls behind in rent. And he tries to keep his house, which is this like special place in the neighborhood. It's the house where all the kids go to after school, and it doesn't work out for him. We meet Vanetta, who was this devoted mother of 3, who organized a Easter egg hunt in the homeless shelter when her kids were evicted, trying to bring light and humor into this really dark time. She was a woman whose hours had been cut at Old Country Buffet, and she didn't have any criminal record, but she was so terrified of eviction and seeing her kids on the street that she committed an armed robbery to try to keep a roof over their head. And we meet their landlords. And I don't have time today to talk about all the stories in this book, but I'm going to tell you one story today. I'm going to tell you Arlene's story. So it had been a really difficult year ever since the snowball. Arlene's 14-year-old son, Jory, had been cutting up with his cousin tossing snowballs at passing cars. And Jory packed this really good one and just like flat this car, hit this car hard. And it jerked to a stop. And this man jumped out. And Jory and his cousin ran inside and locked the door. And the man came up and kicked the door and broke the door down. And he left before anything else happened, thank God. But when the landlord found out about that, she evicted Jory's mom, Arlene, for damaging property. And Arlene cussed Jory because she couldn't cuss the landlord. So Arlene took her 2 boys, Jory and Jafar, who was 6 at the time, took them to the Salvation Army homeless shelter, which everyone in Milwaukee calls the Lodge. So you can tell your kids, like, we're staying at the Lodge tonight, like it's a hotel. And from there, they were on the search for another place to live. And they found a house on 19th Street. There was often no water, and Jory had to bucket out what was in the toilet. It was quiet, Arlene remembered, and 525 for a whole house. It was my favorite place. We know from the survey data that families that get evicted relocate to much worse housing afterwards. They live with things like lead paint and exposed wires and backup plumbing. And if we want to know why some kids, some low-income families live in much worse housing than others, which is terrible for kids' health, one answer is that they're forced to in the harried aftermath of an eviction. So the city eventually found Arlene's favorite place. This is it, unfit for human habitation. And men with hard hats came and they boarded up the windows and the doors. And Arlene and the boys were again on the hunt for a new house. And she told Jory, we take whatever we can get. And that's what neighborhood and housing selection looks like at the bottom, just taking whatever you can get. And what Arlene could get was a draft apartment complex on Atkinson Avenue. But she soon learned it was a haven for drug dealers. It was bad. The whole block actually was drug soaked, and she feared for her boys, especially for Jory, who had this like beautiful smile and was goofy and had these slack shoulders and would talk to anyone and was eager to prove himself like so many 14-year-olds are. So for Arlene, why she moved, the fact that she was evicted, that was the reason why she ended up in such a bad neighborhood. And that's something you can test with statistical data too, and we did, and we found that poor families controlling on all sorts of stuff move from poor neighborhoods to even poorer neighborhoods after they're evicted. They move from high crime neighborhoods to even more dangerous neighborhoods after their eviction. Arlene moved out as soon as she could. She found a two-bedroom apartment, bottom unit duplex on 13th Street. There was a fist-sized hole in the living room window. The carpet was like terrible and filthy, ground to the floor. The door had to be locked with this ugly wooden plank that he slid into brackets. But Arlene put on a good face. She hung ivory curtains and she stuffed a piece of cloth into the hole in the window. The rent at the time was $550 a month, utilities not included, which was the going rate in one of the worst neighborhoods in America's fourth poorest city. That rent took 88% of Arlene's welfare check. She knew some months she'd have to sell her food stamps to get by, and the boys would try to get by with eating oodles and noodles. There'd be no extra money for, like, anything. Anything. No toys for Jafaris, no clothes or books for Jory. So Jafaris had this amazing habit of finding just whatever he could in the basement, like buckets and like a dog leash, and making them into like soldiers locked in battle. For almost a century in the United States, there's been a consensus that we should spend no more than 30% of our income on housing. That gives us enough money for transportation and savings and food. And for a long time, most renters in my country were successful. They did that. But times have changed to the point that today, the majority of poor renting families in America spend at least half of their income on housing. And about one in four spends over 70% of their income just on rent and utilities. Just think about that for a second. Like 70% of your income on the first of the month is gone. Poof. Out. Under those conditions, you don't need like a major shock or a misstep to invite eviction. Something as innocent as a snowball can do it. For people like Arlene, eviction is much more of an inevitability than the result of irresponsibility. So what has happened? Over the last decade, housing costs in the United States, and all around the world actually, have exploded. Between 1995 and today, median rent in the United States has increased by over 70%. Utilities are a big story too. Over the 2000s, utility costs shot up by over 50% thanks to global competition and expiration of price caps. But during the years where more and more poor families were watching their incomes watching their housing costs soar, their incomes were stagnant. We've seen basically no growth with respect to wages at the bottom of the income distribution for families with a high school education or less. So there's a widening gap between what poor families have and what they're asked to pay for shelter. And during the years where more and more families were in need of housing assistance, fewer and fewer families were receiving it. I think most folks in America still believe that the typical low-income family lives in public housing or benefits from some kind of housing assistance, but in America, the opposite is true. Only about one in four families that qualify for any kind of housing assistance receive it, which would be unthinkable with other kinds of government assistance for basic needs. Like, imagine if we turn away three in four families for food stamps, saying, sorry, we just don't have enough, like you have to go hungry. But that's exactly how we treat families searching for housing in the US. Arlene gave up looking for housing a long time ago. But one day on a whim, she stopped by the housing authority and asked about the list, which is like the list that all rent assistance people are on. And she was told by the woman behind the glass, the list is frozen. Because on it were over 3,500 families who had applied for rent assistance 4 years ago. And it could be like way worse. Like in some of our biggest cities in the US, the waiting list for public housing is not counted in years, it's counted in decades. So if you're like a young parent, and you apply for public housing in Washington, D.C., you're probably a grandparent by the time your application comes up for renewal. So if Arlene wanted public housing, this is what she'd have to do. She'd have to wait 2 or 3 years until the list unfroze. Then she'd have to wait about 5 years until her application made it to the top of the pile. And then she'd just like have to pray that the person with the heavy stamp reviewing her application would overlook all the evictions that she'd collected while trying to make ends meet in the private market on a welfare shelter. So on 13th Street, Arlene found like this bucket of paint and rollers and brushes in the basement, and she gave the walls a fresh coat. But not long after she moved in, her sister died, wasn't her biological sister, but it was her spiritual sister, like really close friends. And Arlene contributed some money to the funeral. She didn't have the money, but no one else did either. And she felt it was her duty to do it. She felt she would have been ashamed of herself if she didn't help pay for it. The next month, World Traveler.
Yes.
Sorry, guys. She's in 13th Street, her sister passes away, she pays her funeral. She falls a little bit behind. The next month, she missed an appointment with her welfare caseworker because the letter announcing the appointment was mailed to 19th Street, or maybe it was Atkinson Avenue. In any case, the caseworker types something into her computer, and Arlene's $628 a month welfare check was cut. They call it being sanctioned. And 2 months behind, she got the pink papers, the eviction summons and complaint. So Milwaukee is a city of about 105,000 renter households. Every year in that city, landlords evict about 16,000 people. That's 40 people a day evicted in the city of Milwaukee. If you look just in the inner city, you learn that 1 in 14 renter households are evicted every year. That makes eviction, frankly, commonplace, regular in the city's poorest neighborhoods. We've crunched the numbers in Kansas City, in Cleveland, in Chicago, and we found numbers that are similar to Milwaukee's. Even if in cities that are very unlike Milwaukee, like New York, see extremely high levels of eviction. New York sees 60 martial evictions every single day. Martial evictions are when the sheriff is physically removing you from the dwelling. Milwaukee's no outlier. And if you look at the national data in America, you learn that renters in over 2.8 million homes report that they think that they're going to be evicted soon. Now, these numbers on the screen are crazy high. And the first time we crunched them, I was like, we must have messed up. And then, you know, we have to do it over again. But these numbers only account for formal court-ordered evictions. These are evictions that go through the court and there's a process. But there are other ways, cheaper and quicker ways, for a landlord to remove a family. So I met a landlord, Joe, actually. Joe will pay you $200 and let you use his van if you're out by Sunday. If you go to get evicted, that's like, that's like, you want Joe's eviction. I met a landlord that will take your door off. And we worked really hard in the survey to capture all those informal evictions that never go through the court. And if you add those up with the formal evictions, and then you also account for landlord foreclosures, like when the bank takes a landlord's property, which causes tenants to be evicted. And you also account for building condemnations. When the city shuts the place down, that's what happened to Arlene's favorite place. When you add all those up, you learn that every 2 years in Milwaukee, 1 in 8 renters are displaced involuntarily from their homes. It's a colossal, huge number, massive amount of instability. Eviction affects the young and the old, it affects the sick and the able body, but the face of my country's eviction epidemic is moms and kids. It's moms and kids. And anyone in here that's been in South Bronx Housing Corridor or any other housing corridor in the country knows that and can see that for themselves. The South Bronx Housing Corridor in New York City used to have a daycare because there were so many kids that came inside its doors. Most Milwaukee households that get evicted have kids living in them. And poor black women and Latino women in general, and mothers in particular, are at especially high rates of eviction. Among renters in Milwaukee, 1 in 5 black women reports being evicted sometime in her life. 1 in 5, compared to about 1 in 15 white women. So the way I've been thinking about this is if we know that incarceration has become this hugely consequential and troublingly common event in the lives of low-income African-American men, that's what eviction is in the lives of low-income African-American women. It's this common yet critical moment. For poor black men, they're getting locked up, and for poor black women, they're getting locked out. But this is something that isn't just in inner city. This is affecting communities all over the United States, affecting white folks and immigrant communities. It's on the coast, it's in the middle of the country. The latest data shows that about 1 in 5 of all renters in the United States, all renters, spend over half of their income on housing. This is something that's a widespread problem. So in eviction court, Arlene was given 2 extra days to stay in her apartment for each of her 2 dependent children. And those days came and went, and she had to be out in a day in early January. So Milwaukee's cold. It's a cold city. And this January was especially cold. The weathermen had been working themselves up. They said it was going to be the coldest day in a decade. They said the temperatures could bottom out at 40 below with a wind chill. But if Arlene waited any longer, the sheriffs would show up, and they would have a sidearm, they'd have a gun, and they'd have a team of movers, and they'd have a folded judge's order, and they would have piled everything she had on the sidewalk. Meat cuts in the freezer, Jafaris' asthma machine, her copy of Don't Be Afraid of Discipline, the nice curtains on the window. So Arlene and her family moved, and Jory, her 14-year-old, loaded this U-Haul truck, this moving truck, that family friend had rented for them, and it was freezing. And the cold gripped him, but he smiled through it. He was happy to help his mom. Arlene didn't know where she and the boys would sleep that night. She had tried the lodge and other shelters, but they were full as usual. She would have to worry about that later. For now, she was focused on taking what she could to a storage unit that she had sold half of her food stamps and a space heater to rent. So Arlene finally found a place in a shelter about 30 miles away from Milwaukee, and she started calling on other apartments. And she called on or applied to 20 apartments, and then 40, and then 60, and then 80. I counted. And she had been accepted to none. Even in the inner city, many were out of reach. And the landlords that owned the places she could afford if she threw basically all she had at the rent weren't calling her back either. And part of the reason, besides her poverty, was her eviction record. So in Milwaukee and many other cities in the United States, your record is like just online. It's just like a website, like eBay. You can just go to it and look up people's record, and it shows a judgment for eviction, and it shows what landlords are claiming that you owe them. And many landlords I've met reject anyone with an eviction within the last 2 to 5 years. And this is the mechanism that explains why evicted families move into poorer neighborhoods and into poorer housing, because a lot of landlords on the market just are saying no. So finally, the 90th landlord, like Mr. 90, said yes. He had a one-room apartment. It was 525. Arlene didn't much consider the state of the place or the condition of the neighborhood. A house is a house, she told Jory. So 2 months after their eviction court hearing, took her 2 months to find this place, they moved in. And they brought everything up, all the kind of clothes and the trash bags and the dishes and just everything that else they had. And when they were done, Arlene just like sat on the floor, and she found this trash bag of towels, and she just leaned against it. And Jory came, he sat next to his mom, and he pitched his head to her shoulder. And Jafaris came over and put his little 6-year-old head on her lap. And they just stayed like that for a long time. So Arlene got her stuff out of storage. She hung pictures on the wall. She liked things neat, so she hung this little sign over the sink to Jory that said, "If you don't clean up after yourself, we're going to have problems." So shortly after moving in, Jory went to a new school. It was the 5th school he had been to between 7th and 8th grade. And that's tough. It's tough to be 14 in a new school. It's tough to be 14 and experience long stretches of homelessness. And he started kind of acting out. And one day, his teacher yelled at him. And he kicked her in the shin and ran home. And instead of calling the principal, the teacher called the police. And they followed him home, and they paid Arlene a visit. And when the landlord found out about that, he said they had to go. It's kids. They can prolong the time that you're homeless after eviction, because a lot of landlords don't like kids. and they sometimes are the reason for your eviction. In fact, when we looked at all the folks that we surveyed in Milwaukee Eviction Court, and we wanted to understand, why do you get evicted and you don't, even though you both are summoned to court and you both owe your landlord the same, and you both have the same household income, the big thing we learned is that it's kids. If you live with kids, your chances of getting an eviction judgment triple in eviction court, all else constant. And what you're seeing in that decision is not the court's discretion, but the landlord's. You're seeing a landlord saying, I'll work with you, but not with you. And it's because kids do things like use your curtains for superhero capes and flush their toys down the toilet and cause a man who's just cars just been whacked with a snowball to kick your door in. They can test positive for lead poisoning, which comes with a pricey abatement order. They can attract the attention of the police, like Jory did. One letter told me kids cause us headache. So after that, Arlene, she kind of started to unravel. It's like I've got a curse on me, she told me. It won't stop for nothing. Sometimes I find my body trembling, shaking. I'm tired, but I can't sleep. I'm fixing to have a nervous breakdown. My body's trying to shut down. Published a study last year that showed that moms who get evicted experience higher rates of depressive symptoms 2 years later. Sticky. And we know that in America, suicides attributed to foreclosures and evictions doubled between 2005 and 2010, years where many cities were experiencing extreme rates of housing cost burden. Every sheriff deputy I know who does eviction moves in the U.S. has a suicide story, a story about a knock on the door and then a gunshot. Just my soul is messed up, Arlene told me after the last eviction. I wish my life were different. I wish that when I be an old lady, I can sit back and look at my kids and they be grown. And they, you know, become something. And we'll all be together and be laughing. We'll be remembering stuff like this and be laughing at it. So the home is the center of life. It's our refuge from work. It's our shield from the demands of school, from the menace of the streets. We say that at home, you know, we're ourselves. Everywhere else, we're somebody different. But at home, we remove our mask. It's the wellspring of personhood. Often when we try to understand ourselves, we think of the home we grew up in. It's where, as children, we play, and as adolescents, we retreat and try, and as grown-ups, we settle down, try to raise a family or invest in work. In languages spoken all over the world, the word for home encompasses not just shelter, but work and shielding, family, the womb. Eviction causes loss. Families not only lose their homes, but children lose their schools. Families lose their neighborhoods. They often lose their possessions, which are either piled on the sidewalk or taken by movers, and you have to make payments to keep it yourself. The biggest eviction moving company in the city of Milwaukee told me that 70% of their eviction moves just get thrown in the dump. It takes a lot of money and a lot of time to establish a home. Eviction can erase all that. An eviction can bar you from decent housing, and it can prevent you from receiving government aid because housing authorities count evictions as a strike against your record, which means in America, we're systematically denying housing assistance to the families that need it the most, the evicted. So evicted families are pushed into worse housing, into distressed neighborhoods. Eviction causes workers to lose their jobs. Ethnographic evidence of this, and we have statistical evidence of this. And if anyone in this room has ever been through an eviction, you know why. It's this consuming, stressful, drawn-out process that can cause you to make mistakes at work and eventually lose your foothold in the labor market. And then there's the toll eviction takes on your spirit, your mental health. And if you add all that up, I think we have to conclude that eviction is a cause, not just a condition of poverty, that eviction, this thing in America that used to be rare, that used to draw crowds, is making things worse. It's casting families onto a much different, much more difficult path. And it's leaving a deep and jagged scar on the next generation. Housing plays a huge role in creating poverty in America. We can't fix poverty without fixing housing. So what should we do about it? This is the part in the top where I become self-conscious that I'm not in the United States and people need to be kind of told what we can do about it. But I'm just going to muscle on, okay? So if our queen didn't have to dedicate 80% of her income on rent, she could keep her kids fed and clothed and off the streets. When families finally receive a housing voucher in America, after years and years and years on the waiting list, they do one consistent thing with their freed up income. They go to the grocery store. They buy more food. And their kids become stronger and less anemic. But the children of most quarantined families in the United States, kids with names like Jory and Jafaris, don't get enough to eat because the rent eats first. What we need is like a housing program for the unlucky majority. And if you can't enjoy basic freedoms our country, your country offers us, like the freedom to invest in yourself, to give your kids a shot, to take place in like community improvement, you can't like take advantage of those liberties without stable shelter. And shouldn't like the right to housing be something that is part of what it means to be an American? We in our country have affirmed right to a basic education, provision of old age, decent education, food, because we recognize that those things are fundamental to human flourishing and economic mobility. It is impossible to argue that housing is not fundamental to those things. I think decent, affordable housing should be a basic right for everyone in my country, everyone in your country. And the reason is really simple. Without stable shelter, everything else falls apart. So how could we in the U.S. deliver on this obligation? I think there's good news here. And the good news is that we've already accomplished a lot. America's made like really impressive strides over the generation, especially when it comes to the quality of housing poor folks are living in. Just a few generations ago, our cities were teeming with slums, and families had to wear their winter coats inside in the winter because they didn't have heat. There were outhouses in the middle of Philadelphia, running water. Babies were dying of tuberculosis. America took on a battle with the slum and won. And I'll be the first to admit that we have a long way to go. When I live in the trailer park, most of the time, I didn't have hot water, and I straight told the landlord, look, I'm a writer, I'm going to write about you and your trailer park. So, like, imagine what my neighbors had to go through. But there's no denying that we made huge leaps forward in America in terms of the kind of housing that poor families are living in. Now, there is also no denying that there's a lot of people working on these issues all over the place. The one thing that I've done with the proceeds of this book is start an organization called Just Shelter. And you can go to this website, should you ever be on the other side of the pond, and you can look at 600 organizations that are working hard to decrease family homelessness, preserve affordable housing, and prevent evictions. So the big picture, though, is the problem as big as the affordable housing crisis in America calls for a big solution, and I think that solution should be a universal housing voucher program. I'm so self-conscious. I'm like, you guys, I'm like, you guys are like, right, yeah. I was keeping the thing. So the idea, as you guys know, is simple. Everyone below a certain income level would be eligible for a housing voucher, and they can take that voucher and live anywhere that they want as long as their housing isn't too expensive or too crappy. And instead of paying 70% or 80% of their income to rent, they would be paying 30% with their voucher covering the rest. That would fundamentally change the face of poverty in America. It would drive down family homelessness. It would make evictions rare again. Families would immediately feel the income gains and be able to buy enough food, invest in themselves and their kids through job training, start them on a savings account. They'd find stability. They could invest in their homes, their community, because they could stay there. Some folks have asked the question, would such a program be a disincentive to work? Totally fair question. There's one study that shows that folks that get about housing voucher, they experience a modest reduction in work hours. But there's a lot more studies that find absolutely no effect. And I think that, in truth, the status quo in America is much more of a threat to self-sufficiency than any housing program can be, because families crushed by the high cost of housing, they can't afford vocational training or extra schooling that would acquire them, that would allow them to acquire new skills, and many can't stay in one place long enough to hold down the same job. So think of all the talent and energy that's wandered because families have to focus so much of their time and energy on trying to make rent when they're in a place and then trying to find housing after they're evicted. I think a national affordable housing program in the U.S. would be an anti-poverty effort, human capital investment, a community improvement plan, and a public health initiative all rolled into one. Poverty reduces people born for other things. The poor don't want some small life. They don't want to eke out an existence. They don't want to game the system. They want to thrive and contribute. They want to become nurses or ministers or run their own charities. That was Arlene's dream. And a stable home extends them the opportunity to give it a shot. So this is the part where Americans think, can we afford it? So some economists have argued that we could expand the housing voucher program to everyone below the poverty line without additional spending if we just made the program a lot more efficient. I think there's something to that because there's a lot of fat we can cut. But there isn't any free lunch. And if we didn't do anything to make the program more efficient, this would probably cost Americans an extra $22 billion a year to extend housing vouchers to everyone that was living 30% of their area median income or less, their incomes were. $22 billion extra a year. That's not a small figure, but that's well within the capacity of the United States of America. We have the money. We just made decisions about how to spend it. So today in the U.S., housing-related tax expenditures like the mortgage income tax reduction far outpace housing assistance for renters. The United States has a universal housing program. It's just not for poor people. So the year Arlene was evicted from 13th Street, federal expenditures for direct housing assistance totaled about $41 billion. That same year, homeowner tax benefits exceeded $171 billion. That number, $171 billion, that was equivalent to the 08 budgets for these departments. Department of Education, of Veteran Affairs, of Homeland Security, of Justice, and of Agriculture combined. Rather large figure. Most of that benefit goes to families with six-figure incomes. So I feel like if we in America are going to spend most of our public dollars on the affluent, at least when it comes to housing, we should just like be honest about that. We should just own up to that. And stop repeating the canard that one of the wealthiest countries on the planet can't afford to do more. If poverty persists in America, it's not for lack of resources. That would be lack of something else. So universal housing voucher program is but one of many policy recommendations. Let others come. What works in Milwaukee will fail in Houston. What New York needs, Detroit doesn't. One city has to build, another has to destroy. Cities in America are rich in differences. They have different gifts and talents and different problems and needs. And so our policies should be different too. But whatever our way out of this mess, one thing is certain. This degree of inequality, this cold denial of basic needs, this level of suffering, this blunting of human capacity, this is not us. Like, this doesn't have to be us. There's no American value. There's no ethical code. There's no piece of scripture or holy teaching that can be summoned to defend what we've allowed my country to become.
A couple of pieces of information. The first is I am going to ask Matt a couple of questions about his book for about, looks like, 15 to 20 minutes, and then we're going to open it up for Q&A for another half an hour, and afterwards there will be a book signing across the hall in room 105 where there will also be refreshments. Okay, so please come and join us afterwards. But before that, why don't you stay right there, and let me just open up the Q&A with a couple of questions. The first one is actually related to the policy question, but I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because I actually think that that is avoiding many of the more interesting parts of your study. But you are very clear that that a lot of the current housing programs that are in place, including voucher assistance, most of the benefit ends up going to the pockets of renters. And you describe this simply as exploitation. You describe the way that people rent to the poor as exploitation. It's not something that is a simple free marketplace or something like that. It's an exploitative relationship. Yeah. And you propose, in addition to that, there are ways to get around this. You regulate this market. In ways that actually remind me, for example, of the way New York was trying to regulate rent markets for a long time. But that was ultimately deemed unsuccessful, although I'm not sure if that was actually on policy grounds or ideological grounds. But to the extent that you're talking about something that's radically different, and you are in terms of scale, but in terms of actual the content of the policy and how it works, how would you sort of address that kind of basic problem?
So the exploitation point is a big point for me, like just as someone that is interested in inequality. And as someone that spends a lot of time at a policy school, we often talk about poverty in this like, we think of it as a lack, you know, like poor neighborhoods lack all these services, or if you're kind of more if you have a conservative take, it's like you lack the necessary skills, or maybe you lack certain values. And we always have this kind of deficit model for poverty. And a big thing I learned about this and this project is just poverty isn't just the result of low income, it's also a result of extractive markets. And we have to be very clear about the fact that some folks, landlords in particular, can make a lot of money off of poor folks. And so why would I propose vouchers, which some studies, including some that I've authored, show that landlords can game the system and actually charge people more for living in a voucher apartment than they're due.
And you have the examples of Sharita doing them.
Higher than market rent, right. And so just to get a little wonky with you guys just for a second. So the way that vouchers work in the United States is there's a rent ceiling. It's called a fair market rent. And that rent ceiling is set at the metropolitan level. So that, I don't know what the London equivalent would be, but like in New York, that means Manhattan and the South Bronx are in the same equation. So it would be like zone 1 and zone 3 or whatever. How many zones do you guys have?
Six.
They might be in the same equation, okay? So that means that the fair market rent for a metropolitan area is higher than the market rent in poor neighborhoods. You with me? Okay. So where do most voucher holders live in the U.S.? It's in the poor neighborhoods. So that gives landlords an opportunity to say, I'll charge you $550, you don't have a voucher, but I can get six from you, I'm going to charge you six. You don't feel it, the taxpayer. And so we could address that. We can have smart algorithms about that. We could shrink the fair market rents. We could be smarter about that and be much more efficient about thinking about price ceilings. So the voucher has a price ceiling built into it. You know, it has something that says you can't charge more than this unless the family is willing to pay more. And I think that is a way to kind of address kind of skyrocketing housing costs and like make sure that landlords just don't exploit the system at the expense of the taxpayer. What do landlords get in return? And I think that if we're going to house most of our poor families like in the private market, landlords have to be at the table. And I know that sometimes when I give talks, I get attacked from the left, and people say, well, you should decommodify land or like build a bunch of public housing. But like, we are bleeding out, right? We are just bleeding out in the U.S. when we have like millions of families spending most of their income on housing. We need to do something at scale now, and there's no study that exists that shows that public housing can do that cheaper than vouchers. It's just much more efficient, even though they have efficiencies in it. And one thing that I think we can offer landlords in exchange for these smarter price ceilings is a real conversation about housing code. So in the U.S., you don't have to take a voucher. You can say, no, I don't take vouchers. So we have to think about if we're going to tolerate that kind of discrimination or not. We don't allow legally landlords to say, no, I don't take kids, even though that sometimes is bad for their bottom line. We should have this source of income linking. The landlords that I spent, it's called source of income discrimination. The landlords that I met, they don't like vouchers because there's like an other inspector. It comes into your house and looks around for all these code violations. Some parts of the housing code are like fundamental to human dignity and like children's health. Like you gotta have heat in your apartment. But some aren't. Like some just aren't. Like maybe it's okay that the stairwell jiggles a little bit. And maybe we need to have a real conversation about that with folks that own our cities. I think that's a trade-off, that's a compromise that allows landlords to meet basic need to make a living and allows tenants to live.
Okay. There are a whole series of questions around ethnographic practice in this book. And in a way, your book seems like an inductive ethnography. I went to this trailer park, all this stuff happened, I followed up the stories, and so on like that. But it also seems pretty clear to me that you had a strategy going in here designed to deal with some problems that you saw on the way a lot of ethnography and studies of poverty are done.
Right.
Maybe you can reflect a little bit on some of the key things that you wanted to avoid doing in the process of conducting this ethnography.
Yeah, that's good. I feel like, okay, we're at the LSE, so I can get a little academic-y here. I have this academic thing about like how I got into this. My editor's like, you need to stop that guy. No one cares, but we're at the LSE, so we can do it. So like, you know, I started studying poverty, and I learned there's basically two ways you can understand poverty, at least in the United States. You can either understand it in an individualized way, so you need more education, you need to work on your values, there's something about you that's wrong. Or you can understand it in this like structural way, right? Where like inequality or poverty is a result of these like massive historical forces that usually reside under like a big word, like deindustrialization, you guys like neoliberalism, you know, some big thing that's seemingly like beyond our control, and just like we've inherited the consequences. Both of those things, I think, are a lot more similar than we think, because they both like pivot on this concept of a lack, and they both approach poor folks in poor neighborhoods as like these like deficiencies, and they don't recognize power, and the fact that you know poverty is this relationship and involves poor folks and rich people alike, and so I wanted to do an ethnographic study that plumbed that relationship. That's how I got into this thing in the first place, actually. I wanted something that brought together poor folks and non-poor folks in this relationship of mutual dependence and struggle and do an ethnography about poverty that wasn't about the poor. And that's why I was like, well, eviction does that. You know, eviction brings in all sorts of people. And if you study the process from all kinds of sides, then I think you might come to a different place of poverty. Right? And one of the most rewarding and revealing parts of the work was spending time with landlords and crunching the numbers, seeing how much they made, understanding the massive influence they have over these communities. And I think that's a different way of doing poverty at home.
Okay, I want to ask you specifically about another dimension, which I was thinking about a lot while I was reading the book, which was the role of following people rather than sites.
Yeah.
So you follow Arlene
through
all of her housing shifts,
but
also Leather Scott and other people like that. And I was thinking about what that actually gets you. So it gets you a rhetorical story, right, which is important. And you can tell this person's story, and that connects the reader to poverty in a way that they probably haven't experienced, which is part of your purpose. But there's other things that emerge from following the story. I mean, so, you know, one thing, well, I guess another issue, there are two issues. One is, as an ethnography, this isn't just an ethnography. So the ethnography is the tip of the iceberg of a broader study of eviction and poverty.
Yeah.
So you referenced in the course of this a number of other studies that you've done concurrently with doing the research on the ethnography.
Right.
So one would be how those two fit together.
Right.
But then in terms of the stories, the thing that I sort of saw being revealed through the story, through the stories was the interconnected nature of poverty, not just rich and poor, but how a whole bunch of problems get linked.
Yeah.
And so what becomes evident in your book that I think isn't often evident in studies of poverty is the way that problems snowball.
So
the question is about the role of narratives in terms of snowballing and linking different types of insecurity, or whether you could have gotten that otherwise.
Yeah. I thought it was like five questions. You guys thought it was like five questions? I'll do my best, Mike. So in terms of like the how all these parts of the study related to each other. I feel like, you know, the study started as an ethnography, and I think that's really important because the other things that came with it were deeply informed by the ethnography and then ended up kind of returning the favor later. And so one thing was just how we asked about eviction. So when I was living in the trailer park, for example, my neighbors, Rose and Tim, were evicted. They totally were evicted. Like, Tim got hurt on the job, lost his, you know, deduction of work hours, landlord took them to court, they didn't go to court, the landlord still took them to court, and they were evicted. But like, they just didn't see it that way. Like, Rose once told me, like, when you say eviction, I think of the sheriff coming and changing your locks and eagle movers throwing yourself on the curb. That's an eviction, we weren't evicted. So if in our survey, we would just ask them, like, they do this in the surveys, like, have you been evicted? They would have said no. We learned to ask the question really differently. And so we put these renters through like nine forced choice questions, which are like, have you been evicted? No. Has your landlord ever told you to leave? No. Did you ever leave because you thought you'd be, you know, all these things. And that's because of the ethnography. And I think that speaks to the value of like a little shoe leather work to survey design, to big data. But there's also ways that it would, like looking at the numbers actually changed the way I did field work. So in the field, I thought, when I was doing the ethnography, I thought women are getting evicted at way higher rates than men. Like I'm just seeing this all the time, and I kind of worked out a theory about it. But then I crunched the court record numbers, and like that's true, but only in non-white neighborhoods. In white neighborhoods, basically men and women get evicted at the same rate. So I was like, oh, I had it like half right or kind of right. And so then I went back to my field notes and I was like, okay, what did I only partially see that the numbers made me look at again? So there was the kind of correspondence between all the methods. And I think that was really important to the way I thought about this thing too. And I think it's important too from a policy perspective. Like when I say eviction causes job loss, I don't just mean I saw Ned in the book lose his job because he was evicted. I also mean we did all these models and we found this really robust statistical finding and we published that too. And I think that gives the argument a bit more power and shows it from different ways. So when you brought up the following folks, you said something about it gives you like rhetorical power, but there's this other stuff too. But I do want to focus on that rhetorical power. I don't think it's meaningless. And one thing that I wanted to try to do with this ethnography is to bring back the sadness of poverty, you know, and like the weight of it, and to make readers feel it a little bit more, and to move them in a certain way, because it's shameful and sad. And like, I don't think we as academics should shy away from those things. I think that's part of the human experience, and if our job as sociologists is to chronicle that and capture that in a really deep way, that means writing in a certain way too, I think. And so I think that's one of the things you get from asking a reader to invest in people and getting you to kind of fall in love with people a little bit throughout the book, including landlords. So like, I've worked really hard to tell you the harder things about landlords, like 3/4 of the way through the book. Because when you got to those, I wanted you to feel like, I don't know how I feel about this person. And that was really intentional because I think that is like accurate. It's really complicated. And so I don't want to lose that little clause, but the snowball thing is right. And poverty isn't just poverty, in America at least. It's like this gnarled mess and this constellation of problems and social maladies that are across dimensions, like psychological material, and across institutions. And I think capturing that, one way of capturing that, is kind of this narrative structure. And it also allows you to see the consequences of eviction in your own eyes, right? You can kind of see what happens finally after an eviction and how that eviction really does kind of change the course of the life.
The rhetorical issue is important because, there are a couple of moves that you make in the book which are interesting. So we get a long story about somebody who became evicted by Sharina and they're sort of playing with their, you know, working with their kids and trying to survive and all that. The next picture is of Sharina playing blackjack in a casino and having to respond to a house fire for one of her tenants. But you have I'll read something that you actually put in the footnote. Matthew shows, he doesn't tell very much in this book if you haven't read it. He's really showing you what's going on. He's not lecturing to you about what's going on, but he does occasionally lecture in the footnotes. And at one point he says in a footnote, there are two ways to dehumanize. The first is to strip people of all virtue. The second is to cleanse them of all sin, which of course is true. And when you spend a lot of time around people, there are all kinds of things that they do. They're doing behaviors that you regard as problematic. And the point, of course, is that shouldn't really matter. But you really elevate this in some places. When you talk about Lorraine spending her food stamps on lobster tail dinners, yeah, and then she has no money for food the rest of the month.
Yeah.
But there is this idea in the book, sort of throughout, that it doesn't really matter what people do. And that seems to me to be so contrary to the discourse on both the left and the right.
Yeah.
That I'm wondering if you've had to struggle with that, or if that's been a rhetorical problem for you.
I feel really strongly that poverty researchers and poverty journalists can't write scared. What that means, I think, is that we can't avoid writing about behavior or aspects of inequality that we just wish would go away, like drug addiction or violence sometimes. And I feel like our job is to really understand those and not apologize for those things. And And so there's a chapter in the book called Lobster on Food Stamps. And what it is Lorraine, my neighbor at the trailer park, she was celebrating this anniversary of her boyfriend who died, and who meant a lot to her. And so she's on disability. She receives $740 a month. Her trailer rent is $550 a month. She's strapped. But this one anniversary, she takes her entire allotment of food stamps that she buys, two lobster tails, king crab, a liver meringue pie, and a Pepsi, and ate it all at once. And it was like a single dinner for her. And when she told me about that, I remember calling Tessa, my wife, and I was like, it's like a Reagan commercial. It's like a Ronald Reagan commercial. I don't know how I'm going to write about that. But Lorraine didn't apologize for that. When I asked her about that, I remember there's another footnote where she's looking at like a TV, a big screen TV, and I'm like, how am I going to explain this to readers? They're not going to understand. And she's like, they don't have to understand. I don't understand a lot of things people do. So she had this way of not apologizing for her existence. And I felt like that taught me a lot about how to write about her and gave me license to write about that stuff too. And I think that, I came to the conclusion, and a bunch of psychology backs me up on this and behavioral economics, that Lorraine's not poor because she's making bad decisions. Like, she's making bad decisions because she's poor. And like the space between where she's at and just like stable poverty is so vast that like there's no amount of good behavior that could get her here. So you might as well level a little. And like, I think that's something that we can all relate to. But writing like that means that you kind of accept the fact that some people, at least in America, will always hate the poor. There's nothing you can do about that. And they'll take something like that and they'll twist it and turn it, but they'd do it for anything. And so maybe you shouldn't write to them or shouldn't write against them.
So why don't we open it up to all of you? I just want to encourage you to please keep your questions relatively short so we can get through as many as possible and give Matt plenty of time to respond. Would you like to take the questions yourself?
No.
Okay. I will take the questions.
Make it work.
Why don't we start with Lisa? Yes.
Hi, I'm Lisa. I'm in the sociology department. First of all, I've got a chapter in my book about Gucci sunglasses, which is similar to the lobster dinner. But the thing that, I'm a sociologist, I'm an ethnographer, and I'm also an activist for housing. I've been doing this a long time. And what we're trying to do here is change the terms of the argument. And I can see with what you're doing with the voucher system is you're kind of accepting the argument as it stands, that we can't afford it or we can afford it, and this argument is about numbers and money and units, etc. Well, what we're trying to do here in London is change the terms of that argument and change it that so we are arguing that a home is a human right, and it's not about units or money, or it's actually a human right. And so I just wondered what you thought about that, because what we're trying to do now, because like you said, you're always going to get politicians, and I do not speak to politicians. I speak to other people, because they will always tell you they can't afford it. Or we've got a situation at the moment where they're taking money from one poor group to give to, this is how they do it. So what we need to do really is change the terms of the argument.
I think my wager on that is that if I show folks how bad it is and what losing your home really does to families, and how that, whatever your political persuasions, if you care about families or work, or if you care about equal opportunity, how essential to that. And I think that showing folks what happens when we have this massive lack of affordable housing in the city, and chronicling that in a deep way, I feel like it's connected to reform. I feel that's connected to reform. And I think in housing, that goes back to like Jacob Riis. And so one thing that I wonder about is I'm trying to have a conversation with a lot of different audiences with this book, and policymakers are one of them. The policymakers do care how much things cost. And one thing that I wonder is if these distinctions between housing is a fundamental human right, which is something I agree with and might come down in the book hard on. And spending, I wonder if they're that different. You know, fiscal decisions are moral decisions. They're normative decisions about priorities and what we think are rights. So in America, we've had this massive investment in public housing in the form of prisons, mass incarceration. It was a moral decision we made. And in some states, that was like, those two things are, like, we literally, like in New York, Cuomo Sr. literally redirected money for public housing to building more prisons. And so I feel like talking about money and those priorities is, in a way, asking or begging the question about what we prioritize and what we do think that our people, our neighbors, are entitled to. But I love the idea of still keeping it on our right. It's hard to argue against that on any
Sumit Kumar from Social Policy. So in the context of the work I've done over the last 10 to 15 years on housing tenure and lending, just two questions to start with in terms of the notion of exploitation. And the second one is about the economic. In terms of exploitation, if I'm sure there's a demand for this kind of yields in the market. So when landlords charge a rent, somebody's going to pay that rent. So I don't know how you would pitch the notion of exploitation. Because we would see exploitation as, oh, you shouldn't charge more than this. But if it's a free market where there is the demand and supply, then landlords, people might argue that you cannot cap how much they charge for their rent. The second question is to do with the kind of the voices issue. I just read The Free Man by Nihal Sethi, which is about a day labor market in Delhi, and about how he spends 5 years with them trying to tell their story as well. And the question is, why do we have to tell these people's stories? Why don't they have the opportunity to tell their stories? But there are thousands of these kind of stories. And so as we research, we write about these things. The question is, we become the conduit, we translate in terms of telling these stories. And that's part of the old phase with our research, where we try to speak for the
Okay. So, go on. Is that thing? In America, you just pull this and it goes out.
you have to turn the projector off.
Okay. So, the rental distribution in the city of Milwaukee, if you look at total rents in the city, and you look at what separates the 90th percentile of rents in the city from the 10th percentile of rents in the city of about 600,000, 700,000 people, that number is $270, which is insane. Which means that the rent for housing in some of the worst neighborhoods in the city, some of the worst housing in the city, is not qualitatively different, that different from rents in some of the best neighborhoods in the city. It's an incredibly compressed market. It's about 64% of rent, almost the entire distribution, which if you line up any other commodity, it's going to be a hell of a lot more than 64% separating the 90th and 50th percentile. So, things like supply and demand and things like exploitation, I think we need to think really empirically about those questions. So in Milwaukee, it is the case that vacancy rates for the cheapest units are in the single digits. It's not the case that vacancy rates in the city are in the single digits. They're actually in the double digits. And in a lot of cities around America, Toledo, Chicago, Houston, Baltimore, they've seen rising housing costs along with rising vacancies. So what gives? And I think that from a landlord's perspective, it doesn't make a lot of sense to lower rents in the poorest neighborhoods, and this is why. Because the inefficiency of eviction, another way of asking your question, right, would be, why don't landlords lower rents, have lower evictions, incur the cost of all those kind of things? And the answer is because there's a cost to avoiding those costs too. And the cost is like having to maintain your properties. So in Milwaukee, if you're a city, you can call the city at any time you want And a building inspector, if you have like a housing problem, if your plumbing doesn't work, heat doesn't work, someone from the city will come out, inspect the unit, call the landlord, and fine the landlord for doing that. You can even keep your rent if the landlord doesn't do that. The landlord is forbidden to evict you if you make that call. But if you're someone like Arlene, who's paying 88% of her income on rent, you're gonna have to ask your landlord's compassion one of these days. And so that means like calling the city and exercising your rights comes a substantial risk of eviction. So there are moments in the book where you see a landlord switch from working with the tenant to evicting her because she called the city on her. And so it's basically cheaper not to maintain your property than it is to lower costs and deal with eviction. And you can not maintain your property because the cost is too high. Because you have tenants moving in and being asked to pay first month's rent, last month's rent, security deposit, and that's basically impossible. And so they move in from day one and are in a very legally precarious position. And so I don't get too hung up on what is exploitation or not. I'm uninterested in those debates, which I find scholastic and not helpful to a policy from a policy point of view. I want to make the very simple point that like we have to pay attention to people making a lot more money than poor folks, and their, whatever you want to call it, their income, their exploitation, their situation in life is a cause of other people's poverty. Whatever you want to call that, that's a thing we have to like think about, I think, if you care about inequality. So voices. It's a real issue. And one of the things that I've done with the Just Shelter organization is create kind of a platform where people have got evicted, they can upload their own story, they can upload their own picture, and we have this editing platform and we're working with people so they can have voice and command over their own story. And that's something that we're really excited about. We've gotten a lot of response to that. I worked really closely with the people in the book, landlords and tenants, when writing this book. They saw it a long time before any of you guys get to see it. We worked through certain things. But I also wonder if a question like that... So let me just tell you what's happened with Arlene's response to this book. When Arlene read this book, she had a conflicting response. She didn't know how to feel about it. You know, and she told me, like, I see strength in my story, but I also see a lot of mistakes. And I think that one thing that I offer her is a new way to understand her story. You know, when she got evicted, she felt shame. She felt it was her fault. You know, she felt responsible for that. And I think that I offer a different interpretation of that for her. And that's something that I think that she's kind of come to recognize and give strength to. And I think this relationship of working with people and listening hard to their voices, but also offering another perspective, could be a potentially beneficial too.
Hi, Richard. We lived in Milwaukee some years ago.
Oh, well.
I assume some people are trying to organize tenants in poor areas. What are the problems and possibilities of that?
There is some movement around that in the United States right now. There's a movement called Right to the City, which is really smart, actually, and well-organized, and are trying to get things done like rent control, which may or may not be politically viable, just cause evictions. In most cities, you can evict someone without a cause. And so they're trying to say, you should probably have a cause to evict a family. That's happening. That's happening mostly in cities like London, where there's a economically diverse rental base. In cities like Milwaukee, where most middle-class families can buy a home, it's pretty weak. And the book kind of tries to address these questions in a way, like, why do tenants tolerate this level of inequality? And it works out this argument that's backed up with the statistical model about how living in a poor neighborhood can be really bad for your political capacity. So what I saw in the trailer park was like, a lot of times when we talk about poor neighborhoods in the U.S., we talk about them in terms of disadvantage and crime, and that's there, but there's also like a lot of help. Like you're relying on your neighbors, and this is something that I saw in the field, and it's something we see statistically, that if you live in a poor neighborhood, the likelihood that you're like helping your neighbors, like watch your kids and stuff, is increased. But the other thing that's also increased is like, you see all your neighbors' stuff, right? Like, so Lorraine got her heat turned off in the trailer park, so she asked you if she can use your shower. So you have to know that her heat got turned off. She walks back to her trailer with a wet hair and kind of announces it to the world. This one woman in the trailer park got her kids removed from her hair. And people kind of sat with her, like they didn't watch it with her because they thought she was going to kill herself. They helped her, but because they helped her, they saw her, they judged her as a mother, you know? And so we see this statistically too, that you have an increase of something that we call like perceived suffering. The level of like harsh hardship around you, the more you help people in poor neighborhoods. And that thing, perceived suffering, is actually negatively related to like political capacity, the degree to which you can invest in your neighbors. So like what you need to survive in poor neighborhoods often starves off what you need to strike. And so I think that that's something that's inhibiting it. But I think that we might be seeing something, we might be seeing a change. And I think that renters in America are beginning to speak to themselves as a class again, with shared interests, like a renter nation, which just seems new to me and politically interesting.
I am the aunt of somebody who was multiply evicted in Milwaukee.
In my book?
No, not in your book.
It's a really small world.
Because he would get drunk and disorderly,
yeah,
and get evicted,
yeah,
and he got into the criminal justice system,
yeah,
and once he was in the criminal justice system, it was more difficult to get housing, and eventually he's now in Chicago, and he keeps going into mental health facilities and rehab facilities and in and out of employment. And the business of, fortunately he's single, but the business of making bad decisions, I don't know what effort there is in a more widespread way to support people, yeah, to make better decisions,
yeah,
so that once they're on parole, they can't just be taken back in because they've done something,
yeah,
that if they weren't on parole, wouldn't be all that serious.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's an important point. The book follows a few addicts closely. One in particular, this guy named Scott, white guy in the trailer park, and he used to be a nurse, hurt his back, got hooked on painkillers, developed a heroin addiction, and kind of landed in a trailer park. And you know, Scott's addiction was the reason for his eviction. And he's kind of in the minority in the book. In fact, like most of the families in the book didn't even drink, which is like a bummer to me because like after like a hard day, I had like a drink and they were just weren't having it. But Scott drank and Scott did other stuff. And I think that he would describe his behavior as part biological and part moral failing. I think the research would back him up on that, actually. And he didn't make excuses for behavior, but we, together, several times, would wake up, like, before dawn and go to the county rehab, like this free rehab. And I don't know if any of you guys have done that, but this is what it's like. You wake up at 4 in the morning, and you get to this place, and you go up the elevator, and it opens, like, at 8 or 9. And when you get there, there's already, like, this huge line of junkies, you know, waiting to get in. And they'll maybe accept 3 or 4 that day. And I did that with Scott a lot, and we never got in. And sometimes Scott left early, and sometimes we just didn't get in. And again, like, I'm not trying to apologize for him, but there is something wrong when you have someone that's actively trying to get better, and we just cut and defunded kind of things like drug rehab. I think that could make an unbelievable difference. Scott eventually got on methadone, but it's really expensive if you don't have coverage. It's really expensive. So he basically had to go homeless to afford his methadone payments, and then he eventually got kind of climbed into sobriety.
So there isn't much support.
We could use a lot more support for that, mm-hmm, for drug rehab. Yeah, drug addiction. Yeah. Hello, back here.
I'm Eileen. I'm from Milwaukee. I'm also a PhD student in social policy. You showed a photo of the circuit court case access that people have in Wisconsin. What is someone's name? And you can find out everything about that person, if they've had a speeding ticket, if they've been evicted.
Right.
And that's something, I suppose I was just wondering if there's a move in Wisconsin against this, or there's sort of a lobby against this, because that's something that's quite specific, particular to Wisconsin. I know other states have that as well. But that's a problem for people also in terms of employment and, employers looking at people and deciding against them.
No, there's no move. The only state that does something to prevent evictions having an effect on your life is California, which has like a 60-day window, like between when you're evicted to when your eviction gets published. So you have like this window where you can find another place and kind of like it might not have an effect on your life. Generally, the larger point here is like when we talk about information and the internet and the spread of information, we often talk about that as a liberating force. But for a lot of poor folks, it's just another cut. You know, it's another way to discriminate or push or punish. There are over 600 companies in America that specialize in collecting tenant information from all over the country and selling it to landlords. So your
nephew
who got evicted in Milwaukee, used to be able to move to Chicago, you'd be cool, you'd be kind of off paper, off record. That's no longer the case. Nothing's following you around. Your eviction can affect your credit because we reported to credit bureaus. And we should also just say, like, in the backdrop of all this, like in the United States, if you're indigent and you go to civil court, you have no access to a lawyer. And so a lot of folks that go to eviction court don't show up because they have to face off either with their landlord or their landlord's attorney. So in some housing courts around the country, 90% of landlords have attorneys and 90% of tenants don't. So claims that come up on eviction records that often look like very official, there's been studies that show that they're riddled with errors and because there's no check on them often. And so Sharina, I'd be with Sharina in eviction court, we'd be driving over, and she'd be like, how much should we charge for that door? Like 200, 300? You know, it's like, it's kind of like, it doesn't matter because no one's going to really ask you about it. And so this is something I think we really need to have a conversation about what records should we have access to? But when you do have policy, you have conversations with policymakers on this, they kind of bring up like a free and open democracy. Like people literally bring up like secret police and stuff. That's what the conversation is like. Our court records should be open. And it kind of doesn't seem to benefit anyone but employers and landlords.
Are you from Milwaukee?
Not me. The only person who was in. So I was wondering about the relationship between the sort of eviction epidemic and voting. So here, for example, some people are saying that people perhaps who were previously kind of apolitical might be becoming more politicized because they sort of perceive an association between their eviction and, you know, government policy.
Yeah.
Here in the US, it's different. And I hardly believe that Obama's done a worse job than George Bush did with respect to, you know, eviction and housing. But I noted, I mean, a couple times in the book, Obama's mentioned. And I think you were saying that, you know, you attended a kind of an Obama party and the sort of awkwardness of that.
Yeah.
But I don't know if people talked about voting or politics and, you know, experiences perhaps before or after their eviction. When you were talking to them.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to punt on your question, not because it's not a great question. It is, because I don't know. And so, you know, I have no data, no finding on the effect of eviction on voting. The only finding I have is on the political kind of mobilization about that. I think there's a case to be made, though. We do know, like, the Moving to Opportunity study, which is a study where we assigned 4,600 families kind of a housing voucher and they moved to different kind of neighborhoods. We know from the work of Claudine Gay, for example, that had an unanticipated consequence on voting. Mm-hmm. The people, even though they moved to better neighborhoods, they voted less.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's something about like being in a social network and just being connected
to
that social fabric. And if eviction kind of tears at the social fabric of poor neighborhoods, I think that there has to be political consequences. We just don't know any empirics on it, but it's something that we could definitely get at if you're interested in a certain dissertation project.
I'm Amanda Shuey, also American, from LSE Department of Social Policy. First of all, I was teaching my students about mixed methods research today, and I want them to all listen to your presentation because I think it does a really nice job of mixing ethnography and numbers and showing why both are important. If they'll listen to it, I don't know. And one will be up on my Inequalities Institute website anyway. But I'm most interested in your idea of vouchers, and specifically what I hear you saying is vouchers are needed because it keeps landlords in check as well, that you can increase inspections on the places that families can stay in. And so maybe with that you could justify vouchers over just providing families more cash, for example, just providing them more money. But I think in the, you know, with food stamps or SNAP in the U.S., what we find is a real backlash among conservative people against food stamps by saying vouchers aren't really vouchers because people can sell them, exactly like what you show in the book. So how is it that the housing voucher will be considered something separate from a food stamp voucher? And how is it that, again, not trusting poor people to decide how to spend their cash, but allocating
money to
spend their cash is less stigmatizing than just giving them more money.
Right. So I think any approach to poverty has to be two problem. Mm-hmm. It has to be about incomes, but it also has to be about expenses. And if it's one problem, we give markets the chance to recoup gains. History testifies to this fact. So in the 1930s, when American workers were rising up and striking and demanding higher wages, industrial capitalists went to like the landed capitalists and said, can you help us put down the strikers? And the landed capitalists were like, no way, man, because like you need to raise the wages, we can raise the rents. And they did. They did. History repeated itself like in the 1930s, where housing markets quickly recouped gains caught by workers. Today, evictions are lowest in what month everywhere you look at? What month do you think they're lowest in? February, because that's when the working poor get their earned income tax credit, which is about a $55 billion benefit we give to help poor working families in America, which has been transferred for some between something that lifts families out of poverty to eviction prevention insurance. So I don't think we can solve the problem fully if we just focus on incomes. I think we often focus on outputs too, extractions too. And how to kind of like sell that, market that, to policymakers, you know, I mean, this is something I'm trying to figure out. But I think that you know, if you're someone like Paul Ryan, Speaker of our House, who is a Republican who has a poverty platform, he wants to incentivize work, right? So like, you can't do that without stable, affordable housing. Like, if you're a social conservative and you care about the integrity of the family and giving kids like equal opportunity, you can't do that without stable, affordable shelter. So I think there's at least ways of entering the debate from the values that they care about, that we care about too, I think, and kind of like keep on stressing it. Vouchers are also much more widely acceptable across the line than public housing or rent control or other things that are pretty partisan.
Yeah, so I'm not from Milwaukee. I spent the last 8 years in Barcelona, in Spain,
yeah,
in the midst of, I guess, the second biggest housing crisis of an industrialized democracy, very linked to the fact that one in five people in Spain lost their jobs in the crisis,
yeah.
In part triggered by, basically, as in the United States, a financialization, an excessive financialization and deregulation of the housing sector.
Yeah.
So my two-part question is, one, do you think there's a link between the causes of the crisis and what should be the solution? Because I see, basically, it's incongruous that a financial crisis that played out in the real estate sector should have this voucher solution. But the second part is that the voucher proposal only amounts to 0.1% of GDP, which strikes me as basically a drop in the ocean for a problem of this kind.
Yeah, so the second point is easier, right? The second question is like, yes.
question is harder, and it's harder because I think we don't really know why cities are becoming so unaffordable. And like, I read the newspapers too. I know the story. I know that the whole narrative about global capital flows, you know, and the financial crisis disrupting kind of the global market, and Russian oligarchs buying in London. I know all that stuff. I just need more empirics on this thing. Like, I just don't think we have enough data on this stuff. And I think that there's certain things that make a lot of sense. Like, we haven't built, we need more supply, and that makes a lot of sense in, like, San Francisco. Makes no sense in Cleveland or other places. So there's parts where the neo-economic model make a lot of sense at work. There's parts where it breaks down. I wonder how, like, much global capital you have to release to actually have this effect that we're seeing in cities all over the world. It seems like that'd be a colossal amount of, like, global capital on the run reinvesting in property. I just think we need, I just feel like this is something that we need a lot more data on, because it's not just London and New York or Barcelona. It's also Delhi. It's also Lagos, where 60% of families are spending at least half of their income on housing, and Africa's metropolis. So, you know, it's something that's happening in the developed and developing world. And, you know, I've studied this problem for, like, the last 8 years or something. I'm not confident enough to say this is the source of it. I don't know if anyone.
One more,
Just going back to the ethnography, in your experience, what does this chronic experience of eviction do to families and particularly their sense of place and their relationship with their home? You're talking about the meaning of home and sense of self. And I wonder if you have any insights about what it does to kids and also to communities who grow up with this particular relationship.
Yeah. I remember this one time Arlene got evicted, and we didn't know the movers were coming. It was a surprise to her and everyone. And so we were up there, and there were like 8 guys just like packing stuff up. This really kind of, and she was kind of trying to take it all in. And, you know, just like imagine that happening to you, right? Like you go home and like there's people in your house, you didn't realize they're packing all your stuff up. And Jafaris comes home, he's 7 at the time, he comes home from school, he walks up to the stairs, and he does nothing. He does nothing. He doesn't cry. He doesn't run for a favorite toy. He doesn't ask a question. He just turns around and goes downstairs and goes out to play. And I think that eviction has become normalized in the lives of children. This massive traumatic instability has become something that's looked upon as a normal course of things. It doesn't require a reaction. And that's like so deeply troubling to me. And eviction talks about that, but eviction also talks about like these moments of like this is a heartbreaking book, but there's also these moments of courage and spunk and genius in the face of adversity. And I just feel like this is an opportunity just to tell you one story about that and close with that. So I was with these two women at McDonald's. You guys McDonald's here, right? So they're homeless. They're Crystal and Vanetta, and they're eating lunch at McDonald's, and this boy walks in. And he was like 9 or 10, he had just several clothes on, and he didn't go up to order. He went around to the table. So he was like looking for scraps. And Crystal, who was 18 and homeless, turned to Vanetta and was like, "What you got?" And these two women like pulled their money and they bought this boy lunch, and Crystal gave this big bear hug and sent him on his way. And turned to Vanetta and said, "You know, I wish I had me at home, I would take him in." And evicted has a lot of those stories too, because although you do see these like terrible effects of eviction, you also see these moments where people just gracefully refuse to be reduced to their hardships.
That's a great point to end on.
Very, very